This is an RNZ podcast.
No mai, haere mai. It's good to have your company for Country Life. I'm Carol Stiles.
And I'm Duncan Smith. Kia ora. We've been hearing how there's barely been a drop of rain since Christmas in some northern parts of New Zealand. Today, we're heading out onto a Waikato farm where the dry is starting to bite.
I'm meeting a butcher-turned-maggot farmer who tries to live self-sufficiently in Taranaki.
And later on, the rural-urban bridge is crossed at a colourful ANP show on Banks Peninsula.
But first to our look around the country. The situation in Northland remains desperate, with no rain forecast in the short term. Farmers have welcomed the drought declaration. There's a lot of palm kernel being fed, as it's the cheapest supplementary feed available at the moment. Cows are being pregnancy tested and empty ones are heading to the works. There's still room to process culled dairy cows, which mostly head to the US processed beef market. Around Pukekohe, the widespread dry continues to make life difficult for the outdoor vegetable industry. Pumpkins without water are close to failure and late maturing onions look similar. Potatoes are difficult to harvest and the tuber moth damage is responsible for increasing rejects. Brassicas and lettuce can only be planted if irrigation is available and in many situations it isn't. Although it's early to speculate, a continuation of the present weather pattern could result in a shortage of some vegetables, at least from the Pukekohe district.
A dairy farmer in Bay of Plenty says his farm is the driest he's seen it in nearly 30 years of farming. They're once-a-day milkers, so he says his cows are in pretty good shape, but silage is getting pretty tight. A backlog at the freezing works is not helping the situation. On the upside, in the kiwifruit orchard, it's likely to be a good-tasting crop, with an unexpected uptick in dry matter level, the good taste factor, although fruit is likely to be smaller than normal. Picking's about a month from now. There's a lot of expectation around the bid price for licences to grow gold fruit, and with a quarter of the crop going to China, producers are wondering what effect the coronavirus will have. There's still a tinge of green in King Country paddocks, although pasture has stopped growing and water is in short supply. Farmers are spending a lot more time mustering to ensure stock have water and shade. The farmer we speak to has been trying to get her jobs, like vaccinating tutus, done in the cool of the morning.
Pasture is still growing in Taranaki, but well below average for the time of year. Even inland areas are browning off. Many farmers are heading to once-a-day milking. Pregnancy testing is still underway. In Gisborne, where many farmers rely on dam water, creeks have dried up. There's still a bit of feed around, though. Rain is predicted over the next couple of weeks, but it will take a major amount to turn things around. It could be a struggle to get ewes up to the weights required. If they're light, lamb numbers could be down. The community is supporting families caught up in the slowdown in logging because of coronavirus.
The apple harvest is due to ramp up in Hawke's Bay. Fruit is in very good condition, with harmful sunburn at the lowest level our consultant has ever seen. He suggests smoke from the Australian fires could be masking the sun's intensity. While the coronavirus has thrown a curveball at growers, there is an upside. Our consultant understands people in China are shopping more at supermarkets, where New Zealand fruit goes, rather than the street markets. Plums, peaches and nectarines are still being harvested. It's continuing to dry up in Wairarapa, where farmers are hanging out for a touch of cyclone weather. The nets are on in the vineyards to keep pesky birds away. There's some frustration at not being able to shift lambs and cull ewes off to the works. It would be nice not to have the extra mouths to feed with feed crops finished. No one's feeling too anxious about the dry, though, but come March, it'll be a different situation.
Apple picking's underway in the Nelson Motueka region. A grower with four blocks says the new Posy variety has been coming off first and fruit quality is excellent. The next cab off the rank is Royal Gala. Staff-wise, he says if it wasn't for RSE workers, there'd be no harvest. Not one person has come to the orchard office looking for a picking job. 10 or 15 years ago, it was a different story. A farmer at the top of the Waihopai Valley in Marlborough says it's very dry, but that's expected in February. Over the past 30 days, he's recorded a mere 16 millimetres in the gauge. There's no green feed for merino ewes and lambs, but they're extremely adept at finding rough and scraggy tucker. Medium square bales of hay are selling for $65 each, and they're going out the door like hotcakes.
It's been a beautiful week at Barrytown on the west coast. Perfect for barbecues. Lots of rain's predicted for early next week, though. While the sun's out, the last of the baleage is being made and a few late crops are going in. Milk-wise, production's holding up well. It's been another warm week with cooler nights in Canterbury. Harvest has been progressing well. Grass seed is now all but done, with barley, wheat, peas and clover now in full swing. Feed levels remain okay on irrigated farms, however, dryland farms are struggling due to the dry conditions. A dairy farmer near Balclutha in South Otago is in flood recovery mode. His farm is bordered by the Clutha and Pomahaka rivers, and both flooded. He says the only time he's seen the Clutha that high was back in 1978. One of the immediate issues last week was managing effluent ponds, and that's under control now. This weekend, a digger's coming to fix laneways and take logs out of blocked culverts. Logs and wire from farms upstream needs to be cleared from paddocks bordering the rivers. Cows are fine, though, and there's tons of feed around. Early scanning results are lower than normal. Milk production's down a bit too, but a few weeks of late summer sun should have it back up where it should be.
Western Southland had the rain, but not the flooding areas further east have had. A farmer up the Blackmount Valley reckons they actually needed the rain, but could have done with half as much as they had last week. It certainly helped to kick along the late sown crops, and paddocks have already firmed up enough to get tractors on to sow grass. Stock-wise, lambs are ready to go away, but congestion at the freezing works is holding things up. Lamb prices are dropping too. A trip to the southern field days at Waimumu near Gore this week has given flood-hit farmers a welcome break. Tons of bark chips on lanes has ensured a smooth passage for thousands of visitors wanting to explore the site. One farmer says it's a great opportunity to chew the fat with other cockies, but it meant he didn't get to see nearly as many displays and exhibits as he'd planned to.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
As you've just heard, while farmers in the deep south are still mopping up after last week's torrential rain and flooding, their counterparts in the North Island are wishing they could pipe some of that water northwards. In Waikato, the generally lush green landscape has changed colour. Northern, central and eastern parts of the region haven't seen any decent rain since December, and many farms have a silvery hue and the grass is crispy underfoot. Waikato reporter Andrew McRae headed out to talk to farmers this week and met with Steve Stark. He's been farming at Mangawara for 29 years. It's about 40 minutes drive northeast of Hamilton. Steve has a 550-hectare farm where he runs a bull leasing operation and farms 1,000 ewes.
Well, we're definitely dry, and drier than normal. North Waikato is always summer dry. We know we're going to get a dry patch in the sort of January, February, March. I would say this is a little more intense, a little earlier on. The maize crops have really taken a bit of a hiding in our area. They are talking rain at the end of February, but you don't know until you get the rain. So it's shaping up for a tough season. We were quite lucky through the spring. We got paid well for our produce. And, you know, we can cope with the dry. We have options that, good balance sheets, afford you good options, I suppose.
Looking at it from here, leaning on the gate, quite a hilly property, but really just tinder dry and very, very brown.
Very brown. I've got to be careful what I do, out the back where there's a lot of longer grass, fire conscious. We don't want to set anything going. It is that dry. So, just treat things cautiously.
How's it affecting stock?
Stock are doing reasonably well. They've got water, which is the most important thing. I have heard of areas where the water is drying up. That would be a major concern. You've got to have access to water.
Do you have to destock when it gets as dry as this?
This year I'm actually buying in feed to try and alleviate the stock. We're waiting for Cal Ewes to go. We've got 200 booked in and they've been on the list for 4 weeks. still don't know when they're going. So, you know, that's a concern when you need to make a move and you made the decision a month ago to do it, but you just can't get them away. You could probably send them to the sale yards and that would take the stock off the property immediately, but I think the discount would be huge.
So how much extra pressure does an extreme dry spell like this one put on you and your business?
It puts mental pressure on you. You do worry, you know. You hope that it rains, and you hope for the rain as soon as possible. But it's always in the back of your mind, you know. You've got to make decisions before it's too late. If we have to destock, I guess we'll have to, but that would be a last resort. I'd rather buy and feed rather than sell at a discount.
And economically, does it put a pressure on you? I'm thinking the relationship with the banks and other pressures.
Well, we've been lucky. We've always done exactly what we said we'd do with the bank, and we've never had any pressure from the bank. I guess for some people, it will be very hard, especially in the dairy industry, you know, where they've had harder years, and their properties are probably, the equity is diminishing, and not through bad management, but just the fact that land prices are coming down. And if they're right up there with that debt ratio, geez, you know, they will have to destock if they can't afford to buy feed, and that'll cost them dearly, I think. Just got to feed your animals, make sure they've got water. That's all you can do, you know. And if you can't feed them, well, you just have to send them off to the abattoir, I guess. And I was talking to our meat buyer yesterday. We just sent our last load of bulls off last week. And just a general conversation, he said it's a six-week wait if I had cull cows to go. You know, that's a long time to feed cows that are going to be devaluing.
So at what point does the situation get from being a, you know, real problem to, you know, a dire situation?
I guess it really comes down to how long you can fund it for. And if you're in a good position financially, you'll probably get through okay. It's when you can't afford to take steps, that's when things start to suffer.
Do you think over the years that you've been a farmer here, and we've had those dry spells and droughts, do you think each time we have one that you learn something a bit different and some other way of doing things for the future?
Yeah, definitely. The big drought that I always refer back to is a 2008-2009 drought. I learnt a lot in that drought, and probably I learnt to make decisions earlier rather than later. The hard thing is with a drought, if you sell your cattle just before it rains, it's the worst decision you made. But if it didn't rain, well, it's the best decision you made, and you don't know until 2 weeks later. So, you know, it's a tough position to be in. Because you're talking tens of thousands of dollars, just like that. You know?
So it's a real gamble.
It is, basically, you know. What's the weather going to do in 2 weeks? You know, who knows? I mean, even the weather forecasters, they give you a bit of an idea, but, you know, you can't bank on anything until it falls out of the sky, can you?
So with these extra pressures, and you've been doing it for a while, do you get to the point where you think, maybe I've had enough?
No, I'm not there yet, no. No, it'd take a lot to knock that into me, I think. I do believe that you grow pretty much the same amount of grass every 12 months. And if you're not growing it in the summer, you'll probably grow it in the winter. So, you know, do the best you can. The beauty of pastoral farming is you've got 12 months to make money. It's not like you're cash cropping where it's all condensed into 3 or 4 months. We used to grow a lot of maize on this area. And we found you could have 2 dry months in a 12-month period and your crops were devastated. Your income was devastated for 12 months. With pastoral farming, you know, you spread that risk over all 12 months. So you can recoup, you know.
North Wakato farmer Steve Stark. If 100 millimetres of rain doesn't fall in the next 2 weeks, it's expected an adverse event or drought will be declared.
For our next story, I'm in Taranaki with Ross Nolly, a man whose aim is to go to the supermarket as little as possible.
Well, I was hoping for the Taranaki Sustainable Garden Festival, and I was trying to think of something a little bit interesting, and I don't like calling it a farm when it's only 3 acres, even though it was part of my dad's dairy farm. So I call it the Garden of Eton, as in eating without the G, just basically as a bit of fun, and that's what it is. It's more about providing food for myself and to try and feed the animals as much as I possibly can off the property.
What made you want to become self-sufficient?
I've always liked the lifestyle.
Did you watch The Good Life?
I always say to my friends, as a 13-year-old boy, when everyone was in love with Felicity Kendall, all my mates, and that was probably the start of it. But no, seriously, no, I did like that. I really liked the the way they did things, and even though it was miles before its time, I suppose. And I've always hunted in that as well, and so it all sort of fits in.
Now, I rang you the other day, and you were just on your way back. You had a couple of animals strapped to the back of the car.
No, just in the boot, in the back of the hatch, just a couple of goats. You can hunt deer and you can hunt pigs with that, but at the back of Taranaki, there's a ton of goats. It's getting a bit hard to get onto places now because a lot of farms are selling them live, of course. But, yeah, and sort of trying to use the whole thing, and I try and find somewhere close to the road so I can literally use the entire animal. So I take the whole thing out, the heads, use the skins for underneath gardens as weed mats, use the feet, all the parts that you can't use. I put in for a maggot farm, which grows maggots specifically for the chickens, which is probably for the hardcore grow-your-own chicken breeder. Yeah, the bones get used up, basically made up into stocks, all the meat, the offal that I can bring out, I cook it up and use that for the chickens for their protein. So basically nothing gets wasted whatsoever. When you take something's life like that, you try to use as much of it as possible because it's not something you ever take lightly. And the day I take something like that lightly is the day I go vegetarian.
So when you left school, what did you do?
I was an apprentice butcher. I did taxidermy full-time for about 8 years, then went back butchering again. And then about 12 years ago now, I'd always done a lot of photography and a little bit of writing and decided I was going to do freelance writing. So since then, I've done freelance writing and photography for various agricultural and rural magazines, Lifestyle Block, Organic NZ, etc., Countrywide, Dairy Farmer magazine, a few gallery exhibitions and what have you as well. So it all sort of fits in.
Right, where are you going to take me?
Well, we'll go this way, I suppose. I should feed the... should feed the ducks. They haven't had a chance to feed them yet, so they sort of compete with the pigs and try to pretend they've never been fed all day when they have been fed. Ducks are the most grubby little animals under the sun, and they just pull through their water, and it's just the most amazing fertiliser. So I've been using it on the rhubarb, and I've got a banana over there and a few things like that, and it just booms away. And if I get a bath set up with a hose coming out of the exit on it, I can actually use it down here without having to lug buckets of pooey duck water, which is just about a biohazard in itself some days, especially when you trip up and spill it, you know, splash it up into your face or something like that. You sort of, you know, feel like putting your hazmat suit on. Just the old 12-foot gate. I've got Buff Orpington ducks and White Orpington chickens, both rare heritage breeds, both dual purpose breeds, egg and meat. So they're actually, I think they're hiding under here at the moment, under one of these truck bodies. But I'm sure when they hear the grain over there, they'll come out. They're a big chicken. This is the fermented grain. And the fermented grain has between 15 and 20% more nutrient available for the chickens. It's like giving them a probiotic every day as well, but again, you still got to give them greens and a meat protein, so that's where the maggot farms and those sort of things come in. And so you've got a friend there.
Aren't they gorgeous?
Yeah, he's a big boy. I shouldn't say it out loud in front of him, but at 10 months old, they kill out at about 3 kg, so the big birds. A turkey is 4 kg, so they're big birds. He's about 3 years old, that one. He's me mate. So he's with the three best girls. But yeah, back to the fermented grain. Normally put garlic in it. I'll give that to the ducks.
Can it be in there too long?
Well, I threw some out there a while ago that had been sitting in the bottom of a bucket for about 6 or 8 months. And I didn't realise, I'd forgotten that I'd let the chickens out, and they just hammered it. Admittedly, chickens have got a cast iron gut on them. They'll, yeah, even more than a dog when it comes to eating disgusting stuff.
They look as though they're wearing a wee bustle, don't they?
They do, don't they? Not the rooster, of course. Come on, boy. And when you throw any food in for him, he'll make a little chuckling sound, and that's calling the girls over for a feed.
Look at you. You are so big, mister.
But he's a really good rooster, and a good rooster's worth his weight in gold because he protects the girls. That's my little banty rooster. Thinks he's 6 foot tall and bulletproof. But the big boy like that, they look out for the girls. He'll call them over to the food with that chuckling sound he makes, but you'll see him, he'll pick the grains up and drop them in front of each of the chickens, especially his favourites, and he'll always eat last. So that's their job. Their job is to protect them, keeps an eye on them, and he finds food for them. So he'll make that call if he finds a bunch of worms outside or something like that. He'll make that call and rush over and he'll pick them up. You can throw little bits of mince to him or anything like that, cooked mince, and he'll pick them up grain by grain and drop them in front of each of the chickens. people got the real wrong idea about roosters. I've only ever had a couple that have been a bit stroppy, but they've lost 3 inches of height quite quickly. I'm afraid there's no need for them when you've got good roosters like that. So the other thing I do for them is I rear maggots for them. Sounds more gross than what it is. All you're doing, this is just here, just a rubbish tin, and I've just got a stick across the top with a bucket with holes in it, throw some offal in it, the maggots go nuts, they drop into the rolled oats that you've got on the bottom, and you scoop the rolled oats up and throw them straight to the chickens.
So there are maggots in the rolled oats?
They're possibly, these have only been near 3 or 4, not yet, but they'll be dropping through soon. That's just goat hooves and what have you, because there's been a lot of studies done. A lot of studies done on them for human consumption, and not even on that hardcore. And the nutritional content's completely off the chart.
So that is actually wriggling with maggots at the moment, but they just haven't dropped down.
They'll just, as soon as they get to full size, ready to pupate, they drop down into the rolled oats. So again, so you've got a big bucket of some sort with a smaller bucket suspended in it, rolled oats or bran at the bottom, and whatever offal, roadkill or whatever, just goes into the bucket, drops through the holes that you drilled in it, and you just scoop them up with a scoop. And it sounds gross. It doesn't smell, as you can see, it doesn't smell.
No, it doesn't.
Because
smell
there's so many maggots there that, it's getting eaten up so fast. The thing you've got to get your head around is, like, roadkill's amazing for it, but you definitely get some funny looks when you're walking down the side of the road and you've got a possum on one hand and the back of the car up and see a few heads turn.
Do you pick up roadkill?
Oh, yeah. You got to get a certain state of mind to do it, not to be too embarrassed by it. But you see the funny looks. What I'd really love to do is get a little gas burner and set a little fry pan up on a walkway just for a laugh, just to see the looks on people's faces. Eh? And the other thing I want to do is next time I get a passport, I want to put Maggot Farmer on the passport just to see the reactions at customs. I wouldn't put it under my bedroom window or anything like that, but it's not as gross as what it sounds. As soon as I hear the bucket rattling over here, you're literally surrounded by chickens.
They like them.
Oh, they love it. Yeah, and especially the little babies when they hatch. Absolutely amazing for them. And the mum just goes nuts, and they do so well on them. They're Buff Orpington ducks. They're a rare breed. They're not the best meat bird and not the best layer, but they're a good general purpose bird. Lovely, friendly birds, good-natured.
They're a beautiful colour. They're a sort of a caramel colour.
Just about, yeah, they're beautiful birds. They look like they're smiling. They just look happy. They look like they're in a heavy sea when they run, don't they? But the thing with the ducks is they just drop their eggs anywhere. Like, I've got this pen here for them, but now there's some laying in there, but they'll just be walking across the clearing and they'll just stop, drop out an egg, and off they go again. But the problem with that is the hawks come over, see the eggs, and unless you're out first thing in the morning, the hawks are nicking the eggs. I've caught them a few times in here, but at least they're not nicking the ducks, so that's a plus point.
Now, you've planted a food forest?
Yep. Mm. I'm just obsessed with different trees. Well, say in this area, the food forest here, we've got the wormwood there, the chickens worm themselves on, quinces, aronia berry, small-leafed linden tree there, another chokeberry, arrowroot, Abyssinian banana, which I always like to wind people up. They were growing Abyssinian banana, Mioga ginger and galangal and subtropical taranaki, worcesterberry, North American elderberry, another apple. I'm not sure what that was because it was a cheapie from the bargain bin and they lost the label from it. There's an old English saying that trees love trees. And people say you plant stuff too close together, but you get the results.
Gooseberries.
Yep, gooseberries all the way along the front with currants behind them.
What do you do with your black currants?
Most of the time when I make stuff, I normally make jellies. I don't eat many myself. I probably only go through about 4 jars a year, but I normally give them away to... If you go hunting on someone's place or something like that, yeah, it's just nice to drop them in a dozen eggs and some preserves or some smoked goat legs like I did there 1 year, some goat hams and things like that, just to thank them for letting them have the privilege of being on their farm.
Do you get a lot of pleasure out of giving away your excess?
Oh, yeah. There's a whole heap of us in Stratford, literally right down to my mate in Bluff, who I gave duck eggs to, and Dorking eggs too, that she wanted to hatch. I posted them down there, and then she saw a bacon slicer that I liked, that she knew I wanted, she had sent it up here. And so country districts aren't like they used to be, where a lot of small farms and everyone did stuff for each other. We've sort of done a similar thing, but over a wider area, and a lot of it's done through Facebook groups of all silly things, a bunch of like-minded people. And we've got a really good group for swapping things. There's lots of my plants from my garden, other people's gardens, and vice versa. And it's sort of like having a money bank to a certain extent, because we're all swapping stuff and no one's keeping count. And like one of my friends I gave some trees to, And she said, oh, I can't repay you. I said, well, doesn't matter. I said, one day you possibly will, but who cares? Because you don't know how it's going to come back. Like, I got quite crook with lepto there about 2 years ago and nearly died from it. And I couldn't feed my chooks for about 3 months afterwards. I just didn't have the energy for it. And friends in town, who we've always swapped stuff with, they came out for the best part of about a month and a half and fed all my animals for me. And I couldn't get to the shop, so they bought the food and I paid them back afterwards and things. So it comes back that way too, and vice versa. You know, we all just looking out for each other, if that makes sense. It's using the best part of social media, I'd say, rather than, you know, all the bad stuff that you hear about it.
So how did you get lepto?
Rat urine, of all things, so I found out. I just got crooker, actually. I was getting more and more sick. I just getting more tired and more tired. And then one night I thought, I was in New Plymouth. And I thought I'd better give the Mediline a ring. And they said, get down to A&E. So I went down to A&E. And so 3 days in ICU and dropped about 9 kg in about 6 days. So I was in hospital for about a week. And they said, if you'd come in 2 hours later, they said you probably wouldn't have survived. Anybody on these Facebook groups who are dealing with rats or anything like this, I must just got a bit of rat urine in a cut somewhere. I always say to them, you know, just glove up. It sounds like overkill, but you just don't want to risk it, eh? You just do not want to risk it.
Right, where are the pigs?
Always amazes me how I can lose two pigs in three paddocks.
Oh, there they are.
Hello, Bella Boo.
She looks like she's got tusks, but it is in fact grass hanging out her mouth.
Well, coonies are a grazing pig. Willow. Come on, doofus. Hello, Willow.
Why do you have pigs?
Because I like them. Oh, the excuse is they eat the grass and convert it into manure, which you can use as compost, but no, because I like them. When I was at high school, we were given our vocational guidance papers by the teachers, and I was writing my Barry Crump phase at that stage. You had to write down your three jobs, and I wrote down pig farmer, possum trapper, and deer culler. And I remember the teacher looked at it and literally threw it down and walked away. So, like, about 40 years later, I finally got pigs. But they're such good-natured things, like... You want your tummy rubbed? Come on, you flop over. Roll over like a good girl. Hey, was there someone different here? Come on, girl. I try to grow as many vegetables as I can in tyres, in the big tractor tyres.
Oh, great big tractor tyre.
And that's just horse manure and stable shavings that have rotted down. And then just plant straight in because it turns into the really, really nice soil. Silver beets coming up through here. Radishes. I let most of the radishes go to seed just to get the seed pods because the seed pods are absolutely amazing. They're a big delicacy in places like France. And you get hundreds and hundreds. They're sweet with a little hint of pepper in them. So yeah, you either stir fry them or have them in salads. Absolutely beautiful.
You must have some fabulous salads.
And that's the whole point of this idea. You know, I've got lots of wild greens growing, even things like chickweed. Now, chickweed's one of the nicest salad vegetables. And it grows like a weed, doesn't it?
So tonight, what might you have?
Basically a salad of broad bean tips, drunken woman lettuce over there, which is a really nice lettuce, purple mustard, this we had last night, some bought spring onions, I haven't got any ready at the moment, and I'll probably fry up some goat steak from the goat I got on Thursday.
Stratford small block holder Ross Nolly. He says goat steaks seem to keep on cooking more than beef or lamb do once they're out of the pan. So if you like them medium rare, the trick is to take them out when they're rare.
Hi, I'm Dave Barton of Remarkable Valet, the cutest sheep in the world. You are listening to Country Life, RNZ National.
Now for our feature story this week, we're at the Banks Peninsula A&P show with Cosmo Kentish Barnes, who's arrived early to avoid the crowds and the heat. He's with show committee member and rural livestock agent and auctioneer, Donald Cook.
We're at Little River in the Witty Domain, where they also play cricket, and the school also uses as well. So, yeah. It's a lovely amphitheatre here. Like, we're in the middle of a valley, on the valley floor here, on either side. We've got hills around us, lovely old oak trees, and the catchment flows into Lake Forsyth. Yeah, it's a beautiful setting.
And you are this year's president?
Correct. So, yep, we have a two-year term, so I was also president last year, so this is my final year of the presidency.
Now, what sort of things are happening right now here?
Well, as we're looking out here, Cosmo, we've obviously got the horses in four rings out in the main oval there now, and they started at 8 o'clock, and they'll carry right through to around about 3 o'clock. Our horse entries are similar, just a wee bit down on last year, and if we look behind us there, we've got the dogs, and this year we've got a big dog section, yard dog, and they started at 7:30, and there's about 58 dogs running today, which is the best numbers we've had. There's competitors up from Gore, and also we've got some first-time novice locals that are also competing today.
And do you have cattle here this year?
We've reinstated our calf section, our pet calf section, but as far as our prime cattle or stud cattle, no, we've pulled the pin on that, and primarily that was due to M. bovis, and it just was getting in the too hard basket, so we got very few numbers, so it just wasn't worth continuing with.
Has M. bovis impacted on your work as an auctioneer?
Yeah, dramatically, actually. You know, when it first came out, you know, through the sale yards, we saw our numbers drop quite considerably coming through the sale yards. There were people that weren't prepared to come to sale yards and buy. They wanted to buy direct off farm. And it's still happening now. People looking to buy stock are wanting to know the history, whether there's been any contact or with bovis cattle, just, you know, the animal health of those animals. They're just looking for traceability more than what they were before, which is understandable. And I suppose the big thing was actually when the outbreak happened, the values of the dairy cross stock in particular, you know, that probably dropped by a third. So, yeah, so it was a big hit for the rural community.
Now, Donald, we've come to the yard dog section. What exactly is happening here?
Okay, there's a course laid out here in front of us, which is emulating what happens just on a day-to-day basis on the farm, yard work on a farm.
Managing the event is local sheep and beef farmer Ben Manson.
It's the Tux yard event. It's a handy dog thing, and you've got to go down into a drenching race and then draft two ways. There's some marked sheep, and draft them. Put the four cleaned, unmarked ones up onto the truck with your dog, all dog-orientated. Dog's supposed to do sort of 60-70% of the work, and put them up on the truck, bring the dog back, or the trailer, bring the dog back, put the dog back up the ramp to get the sheep off, bring them down, and then you let the four marked ones out of a pen over there that you've drafted and put them away through that hurdle and down to a gate in the corner, and you're done then.
Is it a time trial?
There is time. It's about 12 minutes to get round, but time's not really the problem. It's just keeping the sheep on track. The man in the white truck there's judging, and it's out of 100. There's three sections, and each section is 33, 33, and 34.
So what are the key things he'll be looking for?
Straight lines from section to section, and a good clean draft, and the dog not doing any incorrect moves.
Now, Dan, the farmer who's out there now, has just released four sheep from the fences, and his dog's doing a good job.
Yeah, and he's got to put them through that hurdle there now.
Yeah.
And he's done it very nicely. And then he goes to the put-away gate, and once he's shut that gate, his run is complete. See, there's had a wee drift off course. It's not a direct line, but it's pretty good, and the sheep are moving and flowing well. And there again, just a wee roll away. So you put the two together, and it's probably a point he's done there.
At the end of the day, do all the competitors get together and have a beer?
Yep, they do. Some have more than others, and but that's just part of it, I suppose.
I quite like these events. It's good, yeah, good practical stuff that you do at home, really.
South Otago farmer Trevor Wilson has completed his first run.
How did you do?
Yeah, I was happy with the way the dogs are going, yeah.
And how many dogs have you got here today?
I've got 400, yes. Bear is he's about 4.5, 5. This is Liz. She's about a 6-year-old Hunterway. The black dog's only 2, and the other one's about 3, so, yes.
How come you've come all this way to compete?
We've got the New Zealand final in Blenheim next weekend, so it's a good lead into that event to see how your dogs are going.
Oh, so you do this on a regular basis, do you?
Yeah, I try and do these ones, yeah, when time allows or work commitments allow.
If you win this event, will you get points that go towards your national tally?
Yes, yes. There's four events around the South Island, and the top two dogs at those events will go to the New Zealand, qualified to run in the island final, yes. And the top three dogs in the island final will go through to the compete against the top three dogs from the North Island final for the New Zealand.
How long does it take to train a dog to do this sort of thing?
You put the basic steering and stops and things on it just in the training paddock, which, you know, you can do reasonably quickly within a few weeks. But a lot of it carries on into a work. That's where most of the training gets done, in a work situation.
Just in the field?
At work, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And I guess the younger dogs learn from the older ones.
Yeah, they can do a wee bit, although we don't normally try and run them together because they can learn bad habits. So, yeah. Normally a dog that does well at this event is probably something that's slow and steady and just doesn't upset stock.
I love good old Little River, and the show's always a highlight of the year. It's good fun, and seeing all the people that come from town and see a different sort of sense of the countryside, and having people travel quite a wee way, you know, to ride in the show, and we get little stalls and everything from all over the place. So it's a great day out, and everyone enjoys it. It's definitely a favourite.
Sitting in a tiny caravan in the middle of the horse arena is Lucinda Hutchinson. She is the voice of the show.
So my job is I'm the announcer for today. I'm in charge of reading out results and organising the rings and whatnot, and just letting people know what's going on. And people either radio through the results and the place gettings, or else we have papers being run into us and all sorts of other notices and whatnot, what they want read out. So, yeah.
You've been involved with this show since you were a child.
Yeah, since I was very little, probably about 2, 3, I've always been riding in the show, me and my two other sisters. But yeah, just the past few years I've been doing the announcing in the caravan box, so yeah.
Do you get frustrated that you can't actually compete because you're having to do the announcing all day?
Yes, it is a bit frustrating, especially when both my sisters are riding the entire time and I have to talk about them instead of ride with them. But no, I do wish I was riding, but I do enjoy this as well. It's good fun and you get to see all the shows.
Did you have to do any training to do the announcing, or does it come naturally?
No, it's probably Gran who just made me do it from when I was younger, and then, yeah, I like to talk, so it's quite easy, just talk away.
And when you're not doing this, what do you do?
I go to UC, I study at university, and I'm doing a Bachelor of Communications and a minor in Marketing and Psychology. And while I'm studying, I stay in town. I live in town, but during the holidays and that, I'm living at home and helping Dad out and working on the farm, so yeah.
First place went to Annabelle Wright, riding Hokey Pokey, and second place to Fred Fitch, riding Tia.
We always got brought up riding horses because we'd help on the farm, mustering cattle and sheep on horses because it's all hilly and stuff, so yeah. Horses are certainly the easiest way to get around.
So you still have horses on the farm?
Yeah, we use them a bit for working cattle and stuff like that. It's just life makes life a lot more enjoyable and a lot easier.
Lucinda's dad, local farmer Brian Hutchinson, is a steward for the horse events.
In the morning, generally it is round the ring horse classes, and as you see, there's about 9 height classes, so they're in height and mainly height, and the big hacks are in weight sections for different classes.
There are some stunning looking horses here.
Yeah, they certainly are. Right in front of us are the big working hunters, so they're generally the bigger boned horses, but yeah, I think it's about 120. Spread out between all the classes, and then you'll get some more in the afternoon who just specialise in hunter, or it's hunter jumping, where they go over the jumps, so that's in the afternoon. So
yes. How long have you been involved in the AMP show?
And we've been dragged along to, or not dragged along to Working Bees since we're about knee-high to a grasshopper, so yeah, at least 50 years probably almost, so yeah. Just one of the community things our family's always been tied up with, so we... Yep, keep supporting, keep trying, because we need these local things to keep going.
You girls have a stall here. What are you selling?
We're selling lemonade, homemade.
Have you had any sales yet?
Yeah, we've had a few, yeah. Hoping to get a bit more by lunchtime, but yeah.
Yeah.
What time did you get here this morning?
We got here at about 7:45 to set up.
Yeah. An early start.
Yeah.
Well, you've got a really good position here, haven't you? Right, yes. In front of the horse arena.
Yeah, so we can have lots of horses.
And it looks like a lot of people are starting to arrive now, and because it's quite hot today,
yeah.
People are going to get thirsty, aren't they?
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, I'm sure they sure will.
Keep living, running bewitched from Flaxville. Third place to...
A large sign saying Wool leads people into the school gymnasium on the edge of the showgrounds.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Right down the bottom.
I'm Peter Wright, local farmer here. I'm fourth generation, so yeah.
And are you sheep and beef
sheep
farmers?
And beef, yep.
Yeah. What is happening in here today?
So this is just all our classes, the judges here, and judge each section and go from there.
What sections do you have?
So we have a fine wool section. It could be a hogget, and then in the crossbreeds, it's the same class as fine, medium, and a second shear or a lamb.
There are two judges in front of us. What are they looking for in that wool?
So they look for the yield and the micron, and then the type, the colour, the crimp, which is just like a crinkle cut chip.
And what sort of wool is that on the table?
That's a crossbreed second shear.
It's so beautiful wool. It's,
yeah, exactly.
And how much would that be worth nowadays?
That's probably a dollar, maybe a dollar 80, a K.
A kilo?
Yeah. It's sad the way it's sort of gone. Yes. No one's, you know, doing too much with it.
Why do you think wool is worth so little at the moment, crossbred wool?
It's markets and the whole, yeah, just people are not buying it. We need to find another stream of something to use it for.
So what would that wool be used for?
Well, should be into carpets. You know, the crossbred wool goes into carpets. Yeah. And a lot of people don't use wool carpets because synthetics are cheaper. And we just need to find another avenue to yeah, because it's a good product.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Frustrating.
Yeah, it is frustrating, actually.
Whereas behind us,
there's the fine
wool, and that's
and
a different story.
That's yeah, unreal money, really. Giles gets... His DAGs price is our crossbred ewe wool fleece.
So the DAGs off a fine wool sheep are selling for more than
the crossbred fleece. So it's a joke.
Does the price of wool cover the cost of shearing?
No, it doesn't. No, it's definitely a cost now. So it just comes down to animal health.
You have to get the guys in to do the shearing.
You have to get it done. Otherwise, you get fly or you can't go 12 months shearing because you... The ewes don't do as well, lambs don't do as well, so you need to get the wool off. And, you know, the old shearers, they're still going to do their job. Yeah. You know, their costs still go up, so hence it goes on the cocky. So, yeah, we can't do much about it.
So, what, 20, 30 years ago, wool was the main source of income from your sheep, and now it's meat?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's quite sad, really.
Mm. Is that something that farmers talk about?
Oh, we talk about it all the time, but no, you can't do a bloody thing, really.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to see here all this fantastic wool on show because, you know, farmers are doing a great job and it should be celebrated.
Definitely, most definitely, yep. No, it's good that people still support it, really, because, you know, it's not looking flash, the crossbred.
Have you got any wool here today?
No, not myself, no. Yeah. Been too busy and involved in the show. So, yeah.
And, Peter, Donald was saying that next year you are taking over the... Yes. Presidency of the AMP show.
Taking the role over, yeah. Yep. So I've been involved in the show for many years and my turn to step up now.
Now, Donald's not too far from the hall where the wool is being judged. There's the arts and crafts section, and this is in a rather old building, isn't it?
Yeah, so this is the original hall here at Little River and the changing rooms for the rugby club originally, but... Just for this 1 week of the year, we now use it to display the baking and the arts and crafts section of our show.
Oh, I can smell the cakes from here.
It smells inviting, doesn't it? Well, I'll come and introduce to Cheryl Stanbury, and she is a past president also. She's been a steward of our show for many, many a year, and she's one of those ladies that just gets on and gets things done.
So we have all sorts of nice goodies, lots of cakes, breads, jars of stuff, of relishes, tomatoes, all sorts of things. And the children's, we've got children's section right down the end, and believe you me, there's about six chocolate cakes down there, and they look absolutely gorgeous.
And today, are you expecting a lot of people to be walking through here?
Yes, eventually, yeah. It's just a bit manic at the moment because people are still putting entries in. So the judge will come in at 10, she'll judge, and then at 12 o'clock we'll open the doors up to the public. Yeah. Yes.
Are there any cakes you've seen that stand out?
There is one. Can we just squeeze in here for a minute? Sorry. That one. That is a cake.
Oh my gosh, how would you describe that?
I really am not quite sure. That was done by a man, and I think it's absolutely awesome. Very different. Not sure about the fly, but yeah.
Well, basically, it's a banana cake that looks like two half-peeled bananas, and they're huge. And on top of one of the bananas is a fly, a blowfly. How will the judge view this?
I actually don't know.
Peter, to ring 2, if you could please.
The old pens in the livestock area are full of rams and ewes waiting to be judged. David Buttrick is the sheep convener.
What breeds of sheep have you got here?
Dorset Down, Suffolk, South Suffolk, South Downs, Texels, Perrindales, Hampshire, and the black and coloureds. So, you know, we're well supported this year again.
Now, what are the judges going to be looking for in these sheep in the pens?
Well, your meat breeds are looking for as much meat as possible on the animal. So that we used to breed tall, long, lanky sheep or rams, but now they're more compact, meaty type rams to get around the hills. Because years ago, all our rams used to go out on the flats, in Canterbury flats, but now they're all dairy cows, so the sheep have to go further back into the hill country.
There's quite a few people mingling around the shed at the back of the pens. I guess these are the farmers who are showing their sheep.
That's right, and judges and the stewards. So we have a cup of tea, and then they all disperse and start judging, and that's all finished by probably 11:30.
Running Kaholho in fourth place to Charlotte Waddell with Ashton Estee Lauder in fifth place.
Ted Hutchinson.
Now, Ted, you are the patron of the show here, aren't you?
That's right, yes, yep.
How long have you been involved with this event?
Well, on my life on and off, really. I was born over here, so been away a few years and come back, but, yeah, virtually the whole lot, yep.
You must know so many people here.
Well, not really, but suddenly they appear out of the thing. Luckily, they always remember me and say who they are half the time, but, yeah.
How old are you?
84.
Are you a farmer?
Well, I was, yep. I've still got a farm, but I lease it to a young cousin now, but I still live there and do quite a bit of the odd jobs and things here.
Where is your farm?
Over at Magnet Bay, they call it.
Now, I think I interviewed you on a beach over there where there's a shipwreck.
That's me, yep.
You came down on your motorbike. I was down on the beach.
That's right, yes.
And we talked about this old boat.
Yeah, and the whaling station there and everything, yes. Yeah, the Magnet Bay, yeah, the wreck and everything. Oh, that's right, yes, I remember that, yes.
The judging of the Supreme Champion Pony. If all champions could please go to ring 4 for the judging of the Supreme Champion Pony.
As patron, what is your role?
I'm not quite sure. Just they usually get the oldest person on the committee or something, and you're there till you die sort of thing, and then they get the next oldest. And mainly, you know, you sort of get someone who's been president and everything like that, you know, involved with the show.
How long ago were you president of the show here?
In 1969 it was.
So that's, what, 51 years
ago?
Yes,
yeah.
And since then you're always back helping out?
Yes, yep. That's the trouble once you get involved. That's it. But you know, it's just great, you know, because while we're having the working bees, you have a meet all your mates and have a beer afterwards, and, you know, it's just getting everyone involved, and anyone new to the district, you know, you bring them in and get them involved. Yeah.
We are showcasing baby clubs, native plants, artworks and jewellery, Kiwiana painted pots and stones, fermentation products, herbal teas and skincare. Be sure not to miss this tent positioned by the Banks Peninsula Rugby Club. There will be a demonstration of how to make a succulent with live probiotic yogurt. at 11 a.m. All very interesting, so make sure you pop in and have a look.
When you were president of the show 51 years ago, was there a demonstration on how to make probiotic yoghurt?
I'm afraid not. No, we hadn't thought of that in those days.
Things have changed, haven't they?
Yeah, so that, things like that is quite a help for the outsiders, you know, just not really interested in horses or something. They can still come and have a day out.
So today it must be a real pleasure for you to wander around, see the smiles on people's faces and just know that it's another great, great show for Little River.
Oh, it's incredible. Yeah, just look around, all the people meeting. It's a day out, all the locals get together and all the animals come, the sheep, the horses, the dogs and vegetables, flowers, it's just wool, everything, you know, it's just there and gets the whole community involved.
This is a call for back number 5, Alice Hutchinson. Back number 9, Julia Hutchinson. Back number 21, Daisy Watson.
Magnet Bay farmer Ted Hutchinson ending that story from the Banks Peninsula A&P show in Little River. And Cosmo's put a gallery of colourful photos from the day on the Country Life webpage.
And that's it for us today. We'll talk again next week. Bye now.
Bye.